Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. You are going to love my exclusive conversation with Michael Knowles. And later in the week, we are going to be taking your questions. You email us, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Michael Knowles is at the Daily Wire. I run Turning Point USA and the Charlie Kirk Show, as you know. And we both are so into our numbers. Successful companies know that in order to grow faster, you must have the right tools. If you want to take your company from $2 million to $10 million or $10 million to hundreds of millions in revenue, NetSuite by Oracle gives you the tools to turbocharge your growth. With NetSuite, you get a full picture of your business, finance, inventory, HR, customers, and more. It's everything you need to grow, all in one place, right from your phone or computer. NetSuite will give you the visibility and control you need to make the right decisions and grow with confidence. That's why NetSuite customers grow faster than the S&P 500. That's an amazing statistic. NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system, trusted by more than 19,000 companies. It's the last system you'll ever need. NetSuite, business grows here. Schedule your free product tour right now and receive your free guide, 6 ways to run a more profitable business, at netsuite.com/Kirk. That's netsuite.com/Kirk, netsuite.com/Kirk. You guys are going to love this show. And again, make sure you're subscribed to The Charlie Kirk Show. I know you hear me talk about this a lot, but let's keep those 5 stars pouring in. Type in Charlie Kirk Show, hit subscribe, email us, freedom@charliekirk.com. Buckle up, everybody. You are going to love this conversation with Michael Knowles. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
All right, everybody. I am joined by my friend, Michael Knowles. Michael Knowles, welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie. And I would also like to welcome you, Charlie Kirk, to the Michael Knowles Show.
Well, so we were going to do this in person, but social distancing. We are on different sides of the same hemisphere. Actually, I'm in Arizona, not too far from you.
Charlie, I got to say, this is probably the longest you've ever stayed in one place, maybe your entire life, definitely in the last few years.
Oh, no, I actually did the calculations. This is the longest time I have not been in an airplane since high school. So, seriously, it's been 8 years since I've actually been in one place this long. And now I'm starting to understand what normal non-traveling people do, like watch Netflix and go to bed at reasonable hours.
Get regular hours of sleep. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
precisely.
That's kind of nice of that.
Exactly. Yeah, so, but how are you holding up in this existential crisis?
You know, it's so frustrating here in LA because the trouble is every politician wants to one-up every other politician. So, right, President Trump taking the virus very seriously. So as a result of that, Gavin Newsom's going to take it seriously, governor of California. So he's going to institute some regulations. Then Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, he takes it even more seriously, orders a lockdown, all the businesses to shut down. 1 hour later, Newsom's not going to be one-upped. He orders it across the whole state. Then Trump extends it. He's not going to be one-upped. Garcetti's going to extend it for 2 months. I mean, at the rate that we're going, we are never going to reopen Los Angeles ever again, which frankly might be good for the United States.
Maybe, but I guess you're holding up fine. It seems like the Daily Wire is continually putting out very good content. And
thank you. You know, fortunately, Newsom said that podcasts are an essential service, which I might dispute.
Right?
But look, I'm happy to go along with that.
So here's the loophole, that every single restaurant needs to just start a podcast.
And that's a great idea. Wow.
It goes back to this old story of how silly government regulations are and how you can have unintended consequences. One of my favorite stories I always use, and you could steal it, Michael, because I stole it from somebody else. It was this old regulation in India where they had a snake problem. You ever hear the story? Before?
I don't think so. Back in the 1800s.
Yeah, they had a huge snake problem. So the British colonialists came in and they said, "All right, we have this huge snake problem. Here's how we're going to solve the snake problem. We're going to pay the Indians for every snake that they kill and bring in to uh, the central authority or to their, you know, regional capital. So, you know, enterprising Indians said, hey, why don't we just start snake farms and start to, you know, repopulate the snake population, and we kill them all, and then we'll go bring them to the capital. So then all of a sudden snake farms became like a cottage industry, and they actually weren't killing the indigenous snakes. So, you know, for all these government regulations and all these government rules, there's always unintended consequences. So,
well, we just got this big government regulation, relief, bailout, stimulus. I mean, we're talking about $2 trillion. When you look at what it's levered up to be, it's basically $6 trillion. Something tells me you're not thrilled about that. I don't want to speak for you, but that's a lot of stimulus.
No, look, I'm a huge supporter of the president. He was put up against a wall to sign this thing, and he got some really good things in it, and there's just some awful stuff in it. And I'm not alone in this critique. Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, and others have, you know, have talked about this. Look, here's the essence of it is I'm a deficit hawk and I'm a debt hawk, and I'm not comfortable posting a $1 trillion deficit, let alone a $3.84 trillion deficit. So let's just start with that. And there is some absolute garbage in this bill, Michael. I mean, for example, let's just start with the basics of the National Public Radio and PBS, which are basically anti-Trump, anti-West, anti-American megaphones that are now getting another $75 million on top of the appropriations that we're already giving them.
Well, the irony about this, NPR now doesn't even want to carry President Trump's press conferences to update the public on the coronavirus, and yet they're receiving money through the coronavirus relief package.
On top of it. So they got a corona bonus. And so that's $350 million for migrant resettlement. So basically, we're going to fund illegal immigrant resettlement, or it wasn't really clear what that was, but it's basically a slush fund for the reappropriation of foreign nationals into our country. The unemployment provisions are awful in this entire bill. The whole idea of unemployment is that it's supposed to be a safety net, not a hammock. So you could conceivably, and you actually will, earn more money on unemployment than actually doing your job if you had a job. The best part of the bill, I will give some compliment, is the payroll protection part. We're actually going to pay businesses to keep employees on their payroll. They're probably going to extend that. That's only $50 billion, though, of the $6 trillion. The other part that I'm not enthused about, and I did a whole podcast on, I say all this, by the way, as an unequivocal Trump supporter, understanding he has to do this politically. He was put up against a wall by U.S. Congress. He has to do this. But I'm also going to just, you know, share my critiques as I see them. I'm not a big fan of bailing out Fortune 100 companies, especially companies that have billions of dollars in cash and can collateralize their assets when interest rates are super low. So if interest rates are like 10 or 11%, I get the whole argument against borrowing money, sort of. But interest rates are as low as they've ever been. Why can't these companies go borrow money in the private market and then come to the federal government as the last resort? It seems like it was the other way around. Like, let's go to the federal government for basically cheap loans or bailouts or subsidized packages. I don't like that. I think Boeing.
But do you not think? I mean, it just seems to me of all the there's a lot of stuff in this bill that I hate, but of all of it, the part I actually like are these loan programs from the Small Business Administration, and then in particular the $500 billion loan program that then the Federal Reserve will lever up and turn into $4 trillion in lending power.
Hold on a second. First of all, I don't trust the Fed as it is. Second of all, the SBA is widely, by anyone who's dealt in small business, no one likes the SBA. No one's excited about dealing with the SBA. And there's going to be so much waste, fraud, and abuse in this entire package. I absolutely guarantee it. Now, if small business gets actual relief and this money flows, maybe. With currently no NBA, NHL, or Major League Baseball action, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of sports, events, and games to wager on. Or let them bring Vegas to you with their online casino and blackjack. All open 24 hours a day and all online, including their $750,000 poker series. If you are into props and entertainment betting, you can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the weather. Visit the website or use the mobile device and join today and receive a 100% welcome bonus with your first deposit. A lot of fun, guys. People say they love this. So you guys got to understand what BetOnline does. They're your online wagering solution. Visit our good friends and exclusive partner at Podcast One, BetOnline, to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up for a free account and make sure to use that promo code PODCAST1 for your 100% sign-up bonus. Visit betonline.ag and don't forget that promo code PODCAST1 for your 100% sign-up bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. So you heard this probably, Michael, in the last couple of weeks. I'm a private sector first guy, government last guy. And so you probably heard that banks are as well capitalized as they've ever been. So why aren't JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and some of these other banks opening up for small business loan emergency relief assistance right now? before the federal government comes in. The federal government should be a backstop against the private loans if they're over-levering themselves to actually help out this small business that might be in need. I don't like the idea of opening the United States Treasury in a merger with the Fed, which can create money at will, by the way. We are going to see some form of inflation. It's impossible not to see some form of inflation with what they're doing right now. It's impossible. But taking the small business thing aside, okay, $350 billion. A lot of that will do some good. A lot of that will also be misallocated, waste, fraud, and abuse. Let's focus on the big crony capitalist part of this, though. The small business owner right now that has to wait weeks to get this money from the SBA, from Joplin, Missouri, or from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, or from Tallahassee, Florida, they're not going to get the sweetheart deal that the big airlines and the airline manufacturers got. They're just not. I mean, the deals that they have, that Boeing and American Airlines and United and Delta got, are pretty incredible. And right now, United Airlines conveniently said after the bill was signed, they're going to let people off. They're gonna furlough workers.
Right,
like, hold
right.
on a second. I thought the reason we gave you access to taxpayer money is not to furlough workers. And so, look, I say this again with honest critiques of the bill, not a critique of the president. The president comes at it from a good position of wanting to do what's best for the country and also being put up against a political impossibility. I, though, as someone who does not believe in Keynesian economics, who does not believe in demand redistributionism, which goes to my biggest critique of the whole bill, this free cash for people is nonsense. Andrew Yang lost the battle but won the war.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Please tell me.
This is my big problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not stimulative. And so maybe there's an argument to be said, like, okay, some people need access to short-term capital. Totally get that. I'm not discounting it. And by the way, even as a free market capitalist, I think payday lending is awful and disgusting. I think people that run payday lending and do these like 18 to 20% interest rates, I think that is engaging in usury and it's awful.
It's a little exploitative.
So I get the whole idea of opening up capital for people that need it. So why didn't they do this? They say, okay, there's an optional interest-free two-year bridge loan for individuals and families, $3,000 to $5,000 if you need it. Why are they giving people money if they don't want it or need it, not applying for it? That's what's perplexing to me.
Yeah, this is the big problem. Because you know, the issue here is the most politically, you know, give it all, most populist provision of this bill is sending people checks for $1,200 or $2,400, even more money. But it's, I agree with you. There's no evidence that this is going to stimulate the economy in particular. By the way, if this thing drags on for what? It's going to drag on for another 30 days now. How far is $1,200 going to get you? And they're probably going to extend it after that. So that part I really don't like. But I find myself in the least politically popular position where I'm actually defending a lot of the business loans and even the airlines in this, because you're in this position where it's not like a normal financial crisis that's cyclical, that is often caused by decisions made by the financial institutions or made by the airlines. You're in this, I guess, unprecedented position where the state governments and the federal government are forcing these businesses to shut down. And even with the airlines, who drive me crazy, you know, when you look at their cash on hand, I think, now who knows if they're reporting accurately, but as of last week, United and American are reporting respectively, I think, $6 billion cash on hand and $4 billion cash on hand. Plus, they obviously have a little bit in the way of credit. But the trouble for them is they sell their airline tickets so far in advance in the year because people are buying summer vacations, for instance, that now they, you know, usually they recoup people canceling trips with those fees, but they can't charge the fees now during the pandemic. So they could see that cash disappear overnight. You know, I hate to defend big airlines. I hate flying American as much as any you know, mode of travel. But you don't want to get into a position where you've got basically a liquidity crisis, a crisis of just not having enough cash to turn into a broader financial crisis, right?
But we don't have a liquidity crisis. The Fed is pumping in money. So the problem is not that. So if they want to borrow, go borrow. I mean, go to Barclays and open up a $300 billion line of credit. I mean, did they even explore the private market, or is their first stop to get on their private planes and go to Washington, D.C.? They probably didn't fly their own airline
to
go lobby
right?
for the airline. By the way, the greatest irony is some journalist should find out if these airline CEOs even flew their own airline to go lobby for their airline.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That would be good. They might have flown the private division of it, you know.
No, I kid you not. I don't guarantee you, but I dime on a dollar that the United, Delta, and American Airlines CEOs didn't even fly their own dang airline to go lobby for their own airline. By the way, I don't want to see flight attendants or people disenfranchised. However, I don't want sweetheart deals. I don't want people that are able to have access to proximity to power to be rewarded more than others. Am I naive? Of course not. That's going to happen. I want to limit that from happening. But here's the problem is we don't have a liquidity problem. The Fed is pumping in money at record record rates. I don't like that. I don't like that either, by the way. I don't like the idea of just instinctively going straight to the money supply and destroying middle America's purchasing power because inflation is a tax.
But presumably, at a certain point, you know, it's not like it's just putting the money out there, it'll never come back. I mean, the reason the Fed is levering up the $450 billion is presumably on the bet that a lot of, at least most of that money is going to come back into the Federal Reserve at some point.
Maybe. We'll see. I mean, again, the question is how much depreciation of a middle America's purchasing power is going to happen right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so, that's a fear.
Look,
sure.
Inflation does not affect the elites. It doesn't. Inflation actually helps the elites. It helps landowners, people that own a lot of stocks and bonds. Now, the argument would be, well, pensioners and people own stocks and bonds, totally. But the purchasing power of the single mother right now in Kansas City.
Right. Yeah.
Kansas City, Missouri, by the way, not Kansas City. I've gotten that screwed up many times. Kansas City, Missouri, the single mother right now who's dealing in cash, right, who might be cleaning hotel rooms or might be doing minimum wage jobs, her purchasing power is going to go down dramatically with the infusion of capital. I got my political upbringing in the 2010, 2011 post-financial crisis, you know, and I'm of the opinion to be super hesitant with big, massive government intrusions of capital and liquidity at any point, at any time. And I say, why don't we first go to the private markets and also try to diagnose what's actually the issue here?
Isn't that the fear? Because I share your concern. I hate going to the government as the first resort. But there is a fear on time here, right? I mean, you've got something that is a completely contrived crisis from the government. And you don't want to get into a position where business owners, who maybe they have 1 or 2 weeks cash flow, that they've got to sell their businesses or sell their property for pennies on the dollar because they don't have the cash to keep it around. I mean, that doesn't seem very fair.
Well, precisely. But look, again, I agree in some sense, but that keeping the liquidity going on the Fed is necessary. Whether or not it's a good long-term economic decision is debatable, and I would probably say no. But the argument is this, but Michael, we have de-incentivized saving because we've lowered interest rates.
Right.
So why do business owners only have 1 or 2 weeks cash on hand? Because we've incentivized that by pumping in cheap money and not incentivizing saving, right?
Well, certainly on the personal front, yeah.
No, of course. But also, I mean, but a lot of small business owners run the personal through the business, right? There's very little.
Yeah.
They run S-corps, they run C-corps straight to their own personal.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
So there's very little difference between it. So here's my big argument is, my big question about the stimulus bill is, why $2 trillion? Why couldn't this be done in a couple hundred billion dollar increments? Now, the president did make a good argument. Let's go all big at once. Let's use a bazooka. But we as conservatives went after the other administration when they passed $800 billion of stimulus relief back in 2009, right?
And no, by the way, I see your point, Charlie. But the only reason I push back on this a little bit is because I do think the two crises are fundamentally different. You know, in 2009, you had these financial institutions basically playing without the ability to lose. You know, they knew that if they won, they'd get to fly in their private jets. They knew if they lost, the government would bail them out. Whereas in this case, really, it was nobody's fault other than China's.
How's that different for Boeing? How's that different than Boeing?
Because the government told Boeing to shut down. Well, but listen, I'm not defending Boeing because Boeing has structural problems too. But I mean, in this particular case, it wasn't Boeing's decision to shut down the global economy. It wasn't Delta's decision. And so I agree that I'm fearful of crony capitalism, but it does seem like a different situation.
So your argument is basically that government has created this crisis, but government didn't create the 08 crisis.
No, government played a role in the 08 crisis, but there was also corporate responsibility there as well.
Sure, but my argument is government created both crises. And so
yeah, but not solely
either.
Right, it solely created this crisis, but it didn't solely create the last crisis.
Well, careful. People that are correctly managed fiscally, people that saved prudently, all of a sudden they're being penalized, right? What about the companies that are super well capitalized? Let's take Uber Technologies. Uber has enough cash flow for the next 18 months.
Yep.
How are they going to get rewarded? How is this going to incentivize saving in the future? Why do these companies need to be levered up to the sky? Maybe they should be not going through mergers and acquisitions every 18 months. So to your point, to kind of push back a little bit, and this is more of the not fundamentalist free market argument, but just kind of more of that school of thought. Shouldn't we also be praising as much as criticizing? So there are companies like Uber Technologies. The CEO says, yeah, we got enough cash for the next 18 months. We are going to ride this thing out. And their stock went up. Like people say, wow, I have confidence in that stock. Apple, for example, their stock is up tremendously in the last couple of days, despite
manufacturing. Yeah, they've got more money than anybody.
Right, but so the question is, from when, from a corporate governance standpoint, we have actually, we don't build companies anymore, we build deals. Big difference, right? So we build deals that help reward the merger and acquisition firms, reward the firms like Goldman and Sachs, that they get their bonuses, they get their one-off deals. But the question is, we should be building multi-generation companies like we used to when Jack Welch was CEO of General Electric, not when Jeffrey Immelt was CEO of General Electric.
Right.
Jack Welch
right.
built a company that was profitable with low debt that rewarded their employees. Like when Henry Ford II built Ford back in the 50s, not built Ford, but he expanded Ford and diversified it. He was a hawk against debt in a lot of different ways. So here's my question, Michael, is this new fiscal stimulus only going to continue to reward that kind of fiscal mismanagement?
Well,
Yeah,
it certainly could. Although, one issue here is, I mean, good on Uber and good on Apple for having a ton of cash, but I don't think we can expect businesses to have 18 months worth of cash flow without laying off workers. I mean, particularly in the case of Uber, they don't need to worry about a huge employee resource because it's a gig economy.
No, I think that's perfectly fair. What I was a little bit disappointed with, Michael, as being a huge Trump supporter, by the way, and I support him signing this bill because he has no choice.
He has no choice. He's up against the wall, for sure.
Right. He has to take the good with the bad, and we got to do action. I get that. The presidency is different than Congress, though, right?
Yeah.
Congress, especially the Senate, is supposed to be a deliberative body. That's where my critique is, right? Where is the deliberation over this? Where were the conservative dissenting voices that were talking about the lessons learned post-2008, the lessons learned post-failure fiscal stimulus in 2009 and 2010, right? And also, you could have done this piecemeal. The other part of this, and I know, Michael, you don't support any of this, though, but $25 million for the Kennedy Center, that's a joke.
Oh my gosh, it's outrageous. It's
beyond outrageous. Not to mention $250 million to the Treasury so they can get the free cash for people. And so, look, I'm not a fan of UBI. I'm not a fan of demand-side distribution, redistributionism.
Yeah.
It's garbage. It's nonsense. It's bad economics. It puts bad incentives. It's also not stimulative. I mean, I took an unscientific survey here at the Turning Point USA headquarters of our young employees of what they're going to spend their money on. Most of them are going to pay down debt. So basically, it's the opposite of stimulative, right? Sorry for coughing. I don't have corona, I promise.
You better not. Luckily, we're at a social distance, though. But it might come through the prompter. I don't know. The TV.
I'm sure that someone's going to propagandize the public. Did you know that you might be able to get, goodness gracious, you're going to see Zoom stock.
It's going to be CNN.
Completely.
Yeah.
But good economics. Look, economics is the war against scarcity, right? And so, but here's the other question. And this is a super unpopular question. I think that there should be a federal law saying that adversaries of the United States should not be able to purchase assets of the country, such as China. So China should not, China and Chinese nationals should not be able to take advantage of the market going down right now. However, if American Airlines broke up, is that the worst thing in the world? Make no mistake, this is not a popular argument, but it might be an economically sound one. American Airlines just went on the most aggressive merger and acquisition campaign crusade over the last 5 to 7 years. They bought U.S. Airways. They bought everything they possibly could, and they levered themselves up. That might have been really, really good for their stock price. They bought back stocks, by the way, with the corporate tax cut that they got. Why are we now bailing out that bad behavior? Maybe if we went back when there was more airlines out there, maybe airlines would actually be more competitive.
Right. Well, I'd be more than happy to let American Airlines in particular go out because they have horrible customer service. But you better not take away my good
Delta.
But this bill
disallows that.
I love that.
But this bill disallows that. Is that we are now calcifying the bigs and the uglies that will continue to borrow money recklessly. And by the way, if anyone out there thinks you've been treated nicely by the airline, of course, Southwest people is the highest. I can't stand Southwest because I actually like to know what seat I have when I have.
I feel like I'm going to get trampled on Southwest when the people are stampeding down the aisle to pick a seat.
But by the way, people say, well, your bags fly free. I'm like, fine, your bags fly free, yet it's some sort of social experiment in spatial conscientiousness to board the plane. I mean, it's so unbelievably Darwinian.
It's so
awful.
Uncivilized.
It is. Are you guys suffering under student loan debt from the cartel of the colleges? Credible.com is an online marketplace that gets you pre-qualified student loan refinancing rates from up to 10 different lenders. Credible's goal is to help people get out of student loan debt. Who benefits? Well, if you've got a student loan debt, you could benefit. I'm telling you right now, they do a great job, so listen carefully. With everything that's going on in the economy, student loan refinancing rates are unbelievably low. With a lower rate, you could save on interest or lower your monthly payment, which means more money in your pocket. And with a shorter loan term, you could get debt-free faster. Consolidate all your student loan bills in one place. Credible customers have given awesome reviews about how much better their lives have been after refinancing their student loans. On Credible, you see actual pre-qualified rates from up to 10 different lenders, whereas with some other marketplaces, you'll get ranges of rates or ballpark estimates. It only takes a couple of minutes to check rates. Checking rates doesn't impact your credit. They never sell your data, so you won't receive spam and phone calls from dozens of lenders. Please visit right now, guys, to refinance. You'll love this. Credible.com/Charlie. That's CREDIBLE.com/CHARLIE. When you refinance your student loans using this link, you'll get a $200 free gift card, free cash, like Andrew Yang. Fill in a couple pieces of information to check out what rates you are eligible for. Again, this is credible.com/Charlie. Take advantage while rates are still low. Refinance your student loans and start saving. But to close the point is that I think that we jump the gun into a multi-trillion dollar stimulus that we know we can't afford, that will devalue the currency, where I would have liked to see much more. If we were going to do something, two things: payroll protection, all for that.
Yeah,
incentivize
yeah,
people
sure.
to stay on the rolls. The unemployment stuff, garbage and nonsense. You're going to see a stickiness of people staying on the unemployment rolls.
Well, the Democrats put it there intentionally. The reason they allowed those, this was actually the one point where some senators, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and others fought back and said, wait a second, if you increase the unemployment this much, then you're actually disincentivizing employers from keeping the employees. You're incentivizing the employees to stay off. And coincidentally, they're incentivized to stop working just up through the November election. How coincidental is that?
Well, and so if Senator Graham and the good guys like Senator Cruz and others said, okay, we are now going to demand an immediate bill after this bill fixing that, but we're going to vote for all the good stuff. But I don't see that, Michael. I'm not seeing the action to fix that. We are going to have a stickiness to unemployment that is destructive to the core fabric of the labor market in America, where we're going to subsidize and incentivize people to not work. That's not good.
Right. And that's a big, you know, the big issue here, too. You had the Senate vote unanimously. I mean, it was 96 to nothing. And at least we know all of the people who voted for that. But when you look at the House, they refused to take a recorded vote. These guys were so afraid of being on the record that they wouldn't take a recorded vote. So now any of them can take pot shots at the bill, but we don't know. They very well may have voted for it because leadership told them to.
Yeah, I don't like this whole idea that also we're not recording how people stand on bill. I mean, what is this? I mean, that's nonsense. And they're already talking about another stimulus. And look, here's the long and short of it, is that middle America, real small business relief, the best stimulus they could have, Michael, is the green light to go back to work.
Of course.
I mean, that's what they want.
Of course.
And so I understand it's not that simple, and I understand there's, you know, all sorts of competing data and all that sort of stuff. However, I am of the opinion, like, hey, posting a $4 trillion deficit, that should be something that should be deliberated so thoughtfully and critiqued so carefully, not jammed through and passed in what I consider some of the most egregious waste that I've seen in a bill in the history of the U.S. Congress.
And you know, what's so scary here for conservatives is the precedent. Because, listen, I'm fairly amenable to the bill. I can get behind a lot of aspects of it. But the sticking point for me...
You're more amenable than me, but finish.
I know, I'm probably more amenable to it than you are. But the sticking point for me is we are now setting the precedent of the government on a massive scale sending direct checks to people because of a time of crisis. Well, look, maybe this is a real, maybe this is a serious crisis, at least an economic one. But what about the next time?
Yeah, but Michael, I mean, Medicare for All costs $32 trillion, but not $32 trillion a year.
That's right.
That number that Bernie said was over 10 years. We've set a precedent that $3 trillion a year for Medicare for All is not that much.
Yep.
In fact, it's perfectly affordable. But UBI, why not do it every quarter?
Why not?
Every month. And now the smart Alex that always come in my, you know, podcast feed are going to say, well, Charlie, that's a slippery slope argument. Okay, well, first of all, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm asking you the question, why won't it happen? No one has a thoughtful answer.
Slippery slope arguments are good. People sometimes forget this because they say, oh, you're just talking about a slippery slope. Like, yeah, well, everything conservatives have been warning about on the slippery slope over the last 30 years
has
happened.
Come true.
Yeah, so I'd like a little credit for the slippery slope. Thank you very much.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's just using predictive logic. I mean, we know how the left operates. Right. I mean, it's not as if we don't have a blueprint of how the left is trying to use the state to, first of all, advance their own self-interest to destroy our freedoms and liberty. Secondly, to try to do whatever they possibly can to destroy our culture and destroy the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. So, right. Yes, I mean, it's an awful precedent. And I don't think there was the deliberation in the U.S. Congress that was needed and necessary to be thoughtful about what this could possibly do for the freedoms and liberties of others. And so here's the awful irony of this whole thing, Michael, yeah. is that what we should have done, again, there's a lot of shoulda, coulda, would haves, but why didn't we sell coronavirus war bonds? Like, why didn't we go out and say, no, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, it's a fair suggestion, yeah.
No, but here's the argument for it. Why don't we go out and say, all right, here's a 3% interest rate higher than the T-bill, right? Yep. That's what they did under World War II, by the way. We did this under World War II, and it worked great. We are going to finance as much of this bill as we possibly can. We're going to open up coronavirus war bills, and we will not borrow a dollar from China to pay for the virus that China created for the multi-trillion dollars. Yeah. You realize that we're borrowing money from China to try to solve the economic consequences of a virus that originated in China.
This is the trouble with free money, right? This is the trouble when your biggest adversary is your largest creditor.
Well, right, exactly. And we shouldn't borrow any money from China. In fact, I can make an argument that the Fed right now should go buy all the debt from China and get them off the balance sheet completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the way, if we're just going to be floating trillion-dollar coins around, that's a really good purchase right now. Is that the Fed should go buy all the Chinese debt immediately and get them off our balance sheet so there's no leverage there at all whatsoever.
But wait a second. Charlie, I just heard you float an outrageous conspiracy theory that this virus came from China. Is that what you're saying? You're saying the Chinese coronavirus came from China?
I was one of the first people to call it the Chinese coronavirus, okay? And actually, President Trump tweeted me early on, and I was like loving my feed of all these beautiful articles from Bloomberg. Donald Trump upending world order by retweeting conservative activists.
Oh my goodness,
this is great. But by the way, China's America's greatest enemy. Lying is a feature of their society. I'll make a differentiation. The Chinese Communist Party is different than the Chinese people. That's pretty self-evident, but I have to, you know, kind of say that. The CCP, they're a ruling tyrannical they're a ruling tyrannical dictatorship that needs to be blunted and thwarted and counterattacked. We need to hold them accountable. Committees, tribunals, international, all that stuff is nonsense. We need to do something that is going to be so aggressive that the ruling class of the CCP feels it. So,
you know why it's really counterproductive anyway when you go through these international organizations is for the last decade, China has been taking over the international organizations.
Of course.
People keep wondering why the World Health Organization is lauding China and touting the Chinese party line. It's because they installed their own patsy to head the WHO.
And I have some serious questions about our government, not our president, but our government. So I just found out that the CDC has a Chinese office. Did you know this?
I did not know that, no.
What the heck were they doing in January?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
They're just twiddling their thumbs, I think, you know, eating bat soup. I don't know.
I mean, what was this? Did the CDC hear of a city called Wuhan? I mean, seriously, I mean, we had a whole month where we literally have people stationed in there to try to monitor infectious diseases. So look, here, China's got to pay. Here's some ways that we have to make them pay. A permanent tariff put on by the entire world to China of 25% of all imports and exports until they repatriate the entire global loss, which is multi-trillions of dollars. Recognize Taiwan immediately as a free and independent country. That'll really tick them off. Oh my goodness, would that be wonderful. Kick off all the Confucius Institutes of our country completely and totally and categorically. And put on, by executive order or congressional statute, all manufacturing of essential services, hence, you know, essentially pharmaceuticals, and should be redomiciled back to the United States of America. That'll create 800,000 jobs. And by the way, after 9/11, America woke up to the horrors of radical Islamic, you know, fundamentalism, and we said, "Wow, we're not gonna take this lightly." After 2008, we woke up to the horrors of how banks are not properly capitalized and how government lied to us for many, many years, and also how ruling class dynasties are not the answer. After this, I sure hope that anyone who dares manufacture any product in China will be held accountable. And by the way, there should be a little window. I understand you might be over-levered and all this. Within a couple, 18 months, if you manufacture anything in China, I want nothing to do with you. Nothing to do with you. Because these people are backwards. You are going to be aligning with the greatest evil of our entire century. It's time to bankrupt them and hold them accountable.
Well, you know, it's funny because... Well, no, I feel just as fiery as you do, if maybe I'm not exactly on board with every single one of the particulars. You know, one line in the great debate among the right, you know, between the traditionalists and the more, you know, kind of more traditional conservatives and the more libertarian types is this question of international trade and trade with China. But it seems like this is a distinction without a difference. It's perfectly fair to say if you're the most hardcore free marketeer or if you are not, you wouldn't call yourself a libertarian, you know, ever. There's no contradiction there to say, wait a second, China is cheating. China's our adversary. China is in many ways waging a war on us. Cut it out. We can't outsource all of our manufacturing to China.
But look, I'm a Milton Friedman guy, so let me build it out for you. One of the first things we know in trade is that both sides get equally rich, right? So that both sides benefit from a trade. I don't want China to benefit. I want them to suffer.
Yeah.
Therefore,
yeah,
we shouldn't trade with them.
Right.
It's that simple. They're evil. I don't want evil people to get rich. By the way, we've all been sold this lie that the more you trade with China, the more Western they're going to become. They have a million Muslims in concentration camps. No,
right.
They actually become more tyrannical. They become more anti-Western. And so that I think that there needs to be a complete and total global recalibration. Hold them accountable. Make Xi Jinping pay. Xi Jinping is now in the category of evil dictators, the likes of which that I'm not going to name the names, but you guys can name the names for yourselves. That's all I have to say.
You know, it's such a good point that you're making on the previous economic argument. They said, listen, if we just build up China, if we get them really rich on Western goods and Western trade, then all of a sudden, one day they're going to sprout into a Madisonian republic. And it just hasn't happened. It's this backwards view of politics that I think the right wing for a long time had, which was they ultimately kind of accepted the premises of the left. They said, look, basically, politics is just about money. It's just about material goods. It has nothing to do with culture. It has nothing to do with eternal questions. Just give them more money. They'll become Westernized. And look how that turned out.
This is so profound and so well put, Michael, I have to say, because this is the neoliberal lie. And I have some respect for neoliberalism. Of course I do. I mean, our entire Western standard of living is basically built around trade, markets, private property, and fair and free elections, as fair and free as they possibly can be. But here's the lie that I was told for the last couple of years, especially during the Mitt Romney campaign, was the more we trade with these tyrants in China, eventually they're all going to be wearing Levi jeans, sipping Starbucks, tweeting about and basically some countries actually do become more Western. It's not that that is incorrect. I mean, we've seen Eastern European countries that lived under the Soviet bloc truly, truly become more Westernized, like Poland. Okay, can happen.
They've got a little more cultural similarity, probably, than
well.
People
what's
in,
the
you
difference
know, the
here? And I'll give you, you know, the whole Catholic thing some credit here. I have a lot of appreciation for the Catholic tradition, and they believe in God in Poland. So the idea of liberty is actually in their book.
Yeah,
the idea of being free from bondage. China has no idea what it means to have a higher power. So the only power they know is Xi Jinping, or before that, Mao. They are the largest atheist tyrant or dictatorship in the history of the world. And so the more you trade with them, the more money they have, the more they're going to only play into their godless indulgences. And so I think the whole world needs to kind of reconsider that this whole lie that, the more we trade with China, the more that they're going to become like us, and eventually they're going to be watching Family Guy, The Simpsons, and drinking macchiatos and wanting to have fair and free democratic elections. It's not happening.
Yeah, this is the big problem. I mean, this is why culture matters. You know, it's so funny. I joked earlier that you were a conspiracy theorist, but believe it or not, I don't know if you saw this, there's a Business Insider article that actually refers to you in print, if you want to get your lawyers ready, as a conspiracy theorist. I've noticed this now on all of a sudden it's cropping up on Wikipedia all over. The left is referring to totally mainstream right wingers, totally mainstream ideas as conspiracy theories. And in the case we mentioned the Marxist dictatorship, the atheist dictatorship, there is a longstanding intellectual tradition of cultural Marxism. It goes back probably to the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci.
Gramsci.
Yes. Yeah. It was a good accent. It was a pretty good accent.
You pronounce it better than me. He wrote it from prison, though. What did he write from prison?
He wrote his letters from prison, his prison diaries.
Yes.
He wrote a number of essays on this notion of applying Marxism to the culture, because the culture is the only way that you're going to get the proletariat to rise up and be aware of themselves. So this has gone a long time. There are many, many thinkers who fall in this camp. They went all the way up through Herbert Marcuse and the New Left in the 1960s, and all the way today we see this in intersectionality and leftism. Anyway, it's gone on for at least 100 years. Now, if you look up cultural Marxism, all of a sudden, they will refer to even that as a conspiracy theory, and I dare say that that's a conspiracy.
Well, look, I'm not going to get into their terminology because I know what trap they want me to fall into. But I will say this.
Right.
I believe in facts, truth, logic, history, and basically things you can prove. And you can prove that there has been a concerted cultural Marxist agenda that was written about in the 20s and 30s, advanced through the Frankfurt School, took over our schools and our universities, and has tried to deconstruct. It's the school of deconstructionism. I mean, you literally learn about this when you go to some high-priced institution and be trained to hate America. And I mean, look, it's through postmodernism and Jacques Derrida and all these different thinkers and nonsensical backwards ideas, basically around the idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth, which of course you should always respond to. Do you believe that absolutely and apply your own logic to your own thinking?
Right.
And if there is no such thing as absolute truth, and that by definition cannot be absolutely true.
Well, you know,
believe your own nonsense.
You know what they mentioned? Because you mentioned the Frankfurt School, which is this group of intellectuals who came over from Frankfurt, came to America, and then went back. And they're a very left-wing. And so part of the new conspiracy theory designation is they say it's anti-Semitic because the Frankfurt School thinkers were largely Jewish. And so they say if you mention cultural Marxism, it's anti-Semitic. Yeah. What they seem to be ignoring is that the father of cultural Marxism is an Italian guy named Antonio Gramsci, who is very much not Jewish. So, you know, they hurl these epithets around racist, sexist, bigoted, whatever. And it's just a way, Charlie, to tell you to shut up.
Of course it is. No, it's nothing more than a suppression tactic and an offensive tool for them to try to stop debate, dialogue, discourse, and essentially people that might be able to garner a following to be able to actually have a platform. And you see this applied in every single kind of segment of society. And there's so many problems with this, Michael, is that the people that are actually hateful, bigoted, and racist then gets diluted and gets put into the group like you and I. And when you and I actually try to exorcise demons from our ranks, all of a sudden
with an O.
Seriously. Yeah, not exorcise, but exorcise these people. You know, you would know. We could talk about that actually in a little bit. But is the left trying? I think I know the answer, but is the left trying to loop us all together because they don't know better? Or they know better and they're doing it intentionally so they can just have domination, leftist domination, basically.
I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt because it surely is convenient and helpful to them to lump us in, you know, and everybody that to the right of Hillary Clinton is Hitler, and it makes them easier to shut us up. So there's a real convenience to it. But I do also think, in the left's defense, that they simply don't know what we believe. You know, there was that study that came out a few years ago from John Haidt, which showed that while the right generally understands the left actually does not understand the right. And just anecdotally, but don't forget the plural of anecdote is data, you talk to a lot of leftists and they actually don't know what you believe. They actually don't understand the arguments that you're making. So it's obviously
That's
a
right.
little bit of both, but I will give them credit for their ignorance.
I mean, look, I think some leftists know better. I think leftist followers don't. And I think that the leaders do know better. They know where the true hateful lines are drawn. And they know, but they don't even police the evil in their own ranks. In fact, they endorse and tolerate it. I mean, Linda Sarsour, who's an anti-Semitic, anti-Western, she's a Jew hater is what she is.
Yeah.
She's a
Jew hater. And an America hater,
Yeah, and I mean, exactly. And then she just promoted to be what, spokesman of the Comrade Sanders, you know, the make Bolsheviks great again, breadline advocate campaign or whatever.
Oh, she would go to the Women's March and hold hands with Gloria Steinem, the great feminist. What do the hijab and the pussy hat have in common? Very little, except they are both opposed to our sort of traditional culture.
Yes, and the more you study the left, the more you fight the left, like you brilliantly do, you understand that the left is not, they're not united by truth, and they're not united by values, because truth is not a left-wing value, and they actually don't have values. They're united by hatred. That's all they have. That's all the left has. And so you can find, for example, you can find what people believe in, what their nearest and dearest values are, based on what they build alliances around. And so we as conservatives build alliances around truth and commonality and goodness and optimism and love of America, right? But the left, they build alliances around hatred. They, I mean, for example, you have your Sarsour and Gloria Steinem. If you sat them in a room together and you said, what are the things that matter to you most? Sarsour would probably say implementation of Sharia law, the abolition of Israel, and all sorts of crazy, you know, basic, you know, fundamentalist ideas.
Yeah.
Where Gloria Steinem would say free abortions on demand for every single woman, you know, always, and basically
and shout for abortion and
stuff.
Right.
Right. It's precisely. And so those things are at odds, and then you add into there the transgender stuff. I mean, they're totally at odds with each other. But what they have in common is that we're bad. They have in common that the conservatives and the Americans and people that want to preserve Western civilization, the Judeo-Christian ethic, they want to destroy us. They want to silence us. They're united by their hatred. That's what drives the left.
Right. Well, you know, though, I will say, in a word of defense in the politics of opposition, you know, very often having a common foe does bring disparate groups together. So it's a strange thing, right, on the right, that there are people who are trad, Catholic, social conservative guys who wear suits and ties to church every Sunday, and then and have like 15 kids, and they're 25 years old. I don't even know how that's possible. And then there are also guys who are atheist, homosexual, libertarian, you know, socially liberal, whatever. And yet they do have a coherent coalition, because the common foe right now for both of them is this woke leftist culture, which is trying to silence both of them.
I think the difference, though, Michael, and I anticipated that counterargument from you or for someone listening to this. I would say the difference, though, is that person that might be totally different than the Catholic going Latin mass ceremony attending like you, that, you know, wears a 3-piece suit and recites the rosary backwards in, you know, original Aramaic or whatever. You know,
I got to work on my Aramaic, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the language that Jesus spoke.
That's true.
But the difference is that they actually have a love for America. That's what really unites them. And they consider the left, if you go a level deeper, the left is the greatest threat to that love, though.
Yes.
Whereas
that's certainly
true. The left doesn't have the love for the country, and all they have is the hatred. All they have is, at the most elemental core of their alliances between the transgender deconstructionists and the Gloria Steinem feminists and the Linda Sarsour Islamic fundamentalists, is that they actually don't have a commonality of what they want to exist. The commonality between your somewhat accurate depiction that you have the atheist, you know, and the Catholic 3-piece going Latin mass ceremony attending individual like yourself building a coalition is that if you actually break it down, they actually want an America that has markets and private property and constitutional rights.
Yeah, very similar.
And then they find agreement that the left is the greatest threat to those things.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And it's so much, you know, it's not just us Latin mass going Catholics here. It's also evangelicals being the most reliably conservative voter base. And I know you're doing a ton of work in that area with with the Falkirk Center. And what do you see moving forward? I mean, do you think that we're going to have a kind of Christian resurgence in America, or are we going to fall apart?
We have to. And I have so much respect for my Catholic friends. And, you know, I'm always kidding when I say these things, you know, and we have fun. And I actually do have some very serious Catholic theological questions at the end of this.
All right. Lay them on me. I'm ready.
I would love to have you answer, and they're Corona related. But the coalition of belief in a higher power and what you're willing to do about it, and what especially for us Christians, and I think it's nonsense when people say Catholics aren't Christians. That's garbage. I just want to say that as an evangelical. And by the way, I have people that email that all the time, like, Charlie, you have to stop calling Catholics Christians. Look, my grandmother was a practicing Roman Catholic. She believed Jesus Christ was king of the world. And we might have disagreed on sacraments and disagreed on certain papal authority. But Catholics that believe Jesus is king of the world, you're a Christian.
Yeah.
And you believe he's the savior of the world. It's nonsense when people say anything different. So I just want to get that out of the way. But for those of us that believe that Jesus Christ is king and savior of the world and the son of God, there's a huge problem happening right now in Christendom where there's this allegedly woke leftist Marxist garbage ideology that is coming through the church right now that is saying that, oh, Jesus was a socialist, that we need to have more left-wing social activism. And by the way, I will now criticize both the Catholic tradition and I will criticize, you know, evangelicalism, where in evangelicalism you have this happening a lot of mega churches and a lot of the kind of new age churches, especially with bigger populations, and especially in Methodist and Episcopalian and Presbyterian traditions. Now in the Catholic social teaching should not quote unquote trump, no pun intended, the Bible. It just shouldn't. Catholic social teaching can be helpful. It can be supplemental. But when I hear people talk more about Catholic social teaching than I do the actual Bible, I get really, really angry about
it. And very often what they're talking about is their SJW social teaching sort of masquerading as the traditional view of the church.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so here's what needs to happen, though, is that we as Christians need to realize the most important thing in the history of the world is accepting Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. The most important thing. The second most important thing is making sure you can do the first thing.
Yeah.
And so seriously.
That's a good point.
And the second thing is protecting religious liberty, fighting the left, which is the greatest threat to Christianity in the history of the world. I make the argument that God gives his people blessings and gifts. America is one of those gifts. God gave us this gift. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, what are we as Christians? Are we acknowledging it? Are we defending it? Are we strengthening it? Or are we trying to save it? And most Christians, unfortunately, don't even vote. And a lot of Christians vote incorrectly. Too many Catholics vote incorrectly. And you and I have talked about this in the past. But the real Latin mass attending Catholics that get deep into the liturgy and get deep into the traditions of Catholic Church, they actually tend to be very conservative.
Well, because you know why? I mean, this is a point for any like wishy-washy Catholics out there. I think a lot of people, because Catholics vote 50-50, Democrat, Republican, I think they are not paying enough attention, and maybe it's because their priests and bishops aren't directing them to pay that kind of attention, but the Catholic Church has spoken pretty clearly about, for instance, abortion. When there is an option, you cannot vote for a politician who supports abortion.
Totally.
But even socialism, you know, there are popes. I know now it's a little confusing, but popes, especially 100 or so years ago, I'm thinking of Leo XIII, wrote beautifully against socialism, said it was a wicked confederacy, said it was a plague, a pest that steals the very gospel itself. No Catholic can vote for socialism. It says so
John Paul II, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Yep, John Paul II.
John Paul II was the quiet anti-Marxist, not so quiet at times, the Polish Pope who brought down the Soviet Union through private prayer and through direct teachings of you would know this better than I, but he actually
would frequently quote the Pope that I just mentioned, Pope Leo XIII. He wrote Pope John Paul II wrote a great encyclical called Centesimus Annus, in which he says free markets are the most efficient means of allocating resources. You know, it's coming back
to
how
far we've come. Yeah,
right,
and now we have
a current
Pope. Who is very misguided on economics and very misguided on the value of private property. And confusing about it. Yeah, and contradictory. And so look, here's what needs to happen. For Christians out there, we have to be active. And look, in 1 Timothy, it says that you should pray for your leaders for peaceable and essentially it says for peaceable lives, essentially. And the direct translation back to the letter that Paul was writing to young Timothy, who was he was basically mentoring, was that you got to know who your leaders' names are. You got to pray for them by name and get engaged and involved. You know how many Christians complain about how the culture is degrading and they don't know their school board members? You know how many Christians are, no, seriously. And here's what's happening, Michael, and it's so exciting, is that I actually think that our political the political sense that we're making, when you and I, our podcast growth, and your podcast is terrific, by the way. I love listening to it.
Thank you.
And your speeches and what you're doing is actually pointing people back to Christ. So the church has gotten it really wrong the last 20 years. Well, not really wrong, I shouldn't say that. I'm talking about more evangelicalism, and you could supplement this in Catholicism as you see fit. But Christianity has had this misguided notion over the last couple decades. We got to stay out of politics. Politics is impure. Just focus on the church, just focus on gospel building. I'm all for gospel building. I'm all for the church. However, if you ignore the idea in Galatians 3 that the law is a school teacher to Christ, what is the law? Standing for truth, standing for civil society, standing for the order. Remember, the law originally in the Old Testament was a law for the people, was a civil society. Aristotle taught us that politics is the ultimate form of community. And the absence of politics, the absence of community, is also saying the absence of the law. And so what we did is, what we're doing, Michael, I'm sure you see this. You're getting messages, I'm sure, I know you are. Emails and text messages. Charlie, Michael, thanks to you guys, I'm now going to church. Thanks to you guys, I now believe in God. Right? But we don't always talk about the gospel. We talk about it, but we also talk about other things. Why? When people hear things that make sense, when they hear people taking stance on difficult issues in civics and politics and culture, they want to know what the origination of that is, and they want to know what the furthest extent of that is. And in Galatians 3, the letter to the people of Galatians, Paul was saying you can use the law as a school teacher to Jesus, and that's what's happening now. And the church has to learn from that. The church can grow. The kingdom of Jesus Christ can grow the more we get involved in civics, the more we get involved in politics, not the lie that the church taught us the last couple decades.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, this is something that the left has always used. They've said, you've got to get your religion out of schools. And they started doing this in the middle of
that's
the 20th
nonsense.
Century. Well, it's nonsense because they don't get their religion out of schools. They have the religion of secular liberalism,
yes.
Capital S, capital L, with the great cardinal virtues of tolerance, capital T, diversity, capital D, right? And now their own gender theory, which is actually just a new form of Gnostic dualism, an ancient discredited religion. And
yes.
so,
yes.
you know, if they get to keep their religion in schools, perhaps it would help us to, and this is just a modest suggestion, maybe we allow students to read the Bible in schools. You know, the most important book ever written that the whole culture is based on?
I go a little bit further. I say that I've said this publicly, so who cares? But no school should get federal government money unless they require the Bible to be taught in schools.
It's
that simple.
I'm in. Sign me up.
But here's the thing. First of all, you're so spot on, Michael. Leftism is a religion. Okay, it absolutely is a religion. Number two, if you don't teach the Bible, you're now allowing your religion to censor another religion, because the Bible exists, whether you like it or not. It exists. It's a historical document as much as a religious document.
So but not only does it exist, our entire culture is based on it. So even if you don't believe in it as a religious text, you can't understand Shakespeare if you don't read the Bible. You can't understand Dostoevsky if you don't read the Bible. You can't understand the entire history
of the
West. You can't understand Viktor Frankl. You can't understand any of these things. So we're teaching everybody these kind of moments of our culture without the foundation of it.
Right. And so this is evidenced by countries that do not have the Judeo-Christian construct and do not have the Bible as a North Star and the inspiration of its leadership or its founding documents or of its governance or, most importantly, its people. They struggle with this idea of liberty. Some of them are able to do it in some managed form, but over time they struggle with it. And this is, look, the greatest example of this is you're going to see India struggle with the idea of personal liberty. And I love the country of India. It's a great experiment of free markets and private property. They've lifted more people out of poverty than any other country. But still, the caste system is very much built into the ethos and built into the structure of their society. It just is. And the reason why America was different fundamentally, and we don't talk about this, is Jesus was the great liberator. Well, liberty is built into the idea of freedom from bondage and freedom itself. Jesus wanted us to prosper and to be able to multiply and to be able to adhere to, first and foremost, his kingdom. But when you build a society around the idea of religious liberty, understand you just can't pick and choose your liberties. If you have religious liberty, you have economic liberty and personal liberty, all these different types of liberties. Well, all of a sudden, they're going to have prosperity. And so if you all of a sudden remove those books and those texts and just act as if, oh, yeah, we just stumbled upon this liberty thing, it's the norm, you're going to have the absence of that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Precisely.
Yeah, we're standing on the shoulders of giants and we think we're flying. I mean, that's the real threat here. And so I think it's great. I mean, I'm just so pleased that you work on this and you talk about this and you're pushing it through the Falkirk Center.
For Faith and Liberty at Liberty University. We want to get you involved with that, Michael. You would love that. You would be
terrific. Oh, it sounds great.
We are ecumenical, to use a nice word that I have not used yet today. I have not used the word ecumenical. If you don't know what it means, look it up.
Well, speaking of, you mentioned that you wanted me to weigh in from my vast, poorly formed knowledge of the Catholic tradition to try to answer some of your questions.
I wouldn't say it's poorly formed, but I do have a legitimate question. So how is it that the government edicts are shutting down Catholic churches? How are Catholics processing? Because I saw a specific article where priests were encouraging Catholics to not go to confession but go straight to God. Isn't that the whole argument that we as evangelicals and Protestants have been making, that the practice of confession is better done just to God, and that this might actually be an exercise in the invalidation of going through a priest for confession?
No, I don't think so. You'll be surprised to hear that I think that.
It
does help to clarify the sacrament of confession, because you're right. You know, I think a lot of, especially Protestants, but maybe a lot of Catholics, don't understand what a confession is. You cannot confess unless you first confess to God, unless you first have a direct form of confession. Now, if in this case, the
that
sacrament
is a good
of confession,
point.
Right. So people kind of forget that part. So, you know, especially now where the sacrament of confession is closed off to people in most of the country and in Italy and elsewhere, what you do is you can make an act of perfect contrition. So you confess your sins to God, you express and pray your sorrow, your repentance for that, and you make a vow that you will go to confession as soon as you can. The reason for the sacrament of confession comes from a commission that Christ gave to the apostles, which is, he says, here are the keys to the kingdom of heaven. What you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. What you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. He breathes on the apostles. He gives them the Holy Spirit. And he says, you have the power to forgive sins. Whose sins you forgive are forgiven. And then crucially, whose sins you retain are retained. So it's not even like it's a sort of, I would never accuse our Lord of speaking in a platitudinous way, but here it's so clear that there's nothing platitudinous about it. This is a real power that is given by Christ to his apostles and therefore to his church. And so we confess our sins to God, we apologize, in this moment we make an act of perfect contrition, but then we go there because Christ did institute real people. And, you know, one thing that, if people are trying to make sense of the sacraments, one way to think of it is that they're incarnational. Right, they're in the flesh. You can't just do it over a Zoom meeting. You can't just like go to e-mass or something. Maybe you try to and you have a spiritual communion during times of pandemic, but you got to do the real thing. And the reason for that is that Christ himself is incarnational, right? In literally in the incarnation, the divine logic of the universe takes on flesh, becomes man, and dwells among us. And so that's that relationship between the physical world and the metaphysical world that come together in the sacraments.
So, yeah, that's a deeper discussion for a different time. I guess connecting with the corona side of it, though, why am I not seeing more Catholics push back against the idea that you can't get the Eucharist during this time? Wouldn't you make the argument you need the Eucharist now more than ever?
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, the trouble, you mentioned earlier, Charlie, that there are government mandates that are preventing the Catholic churches from opening. And that's true in some places. Bill de Blasio is threatening to permanently close churches. But the trouble for us is it was the bishops who made the decision to close the parishes. It was not the government initially, it was the bishops. And so you've had some people in the church hierarchy speaking out against this, specifically wonderful cardinals, Cardinal Burke and Cardinal Schneider, saying people need the Eucharist. We need the body of Christ. We need Mass. We need the highest form of prayer now more than ever. And yet, unfortunately, you have other leaders of the church who have been more reticent. Now, are they making a look? Prudence is a virtue. They're obviously making a prudential judgment here to say we need to protect public health by closing the masses. But it seems to me there would be so many other ways to keep the Mass open, to keep the sacraments coming, to keep the Eucharist available, and still protect public health.
I just think that it, as a Protestant looking at this from the outside, I think it cheapens the argument, to be perfectly honest with you, Michael, that Catholics always make about the importance of the Eucharist.
Yeah, it sends the wrong message.
Well, I'm like, okay, so we're cool with Home Depot being open as an essential good, but the body of Christ, not so much.
That's right. You can go to Walgreens, but you can't go and participate in the highest form of prayer and receive your Lord.
Yeah, so my feedback is, and I'm sure you agree with this, is you and I have tussled about the Eucharist many times, and those will continue for many years. But I'm not getting into that. I'm just saying, as someone who has been open-minded yet not convinced that the Eucharist is what you say it is and what Catholics say it is, I just am kind of saying this cheapens your argument and sets you guys back a long time for those Protestants that are trying to see it from your perspective.
It's even worse. You're totally on the right trail. It's even worse than that, though, because in recent years, because of liturgical abuses, let's call them, ways in which the Eucharist is not treated with the same reverence that it was treated in years past and that it should be treated, all of a sudden you've got a situation where the majority of American Catholics, according to a poll, don't believe that Christ is really present in the Eucharist. That's the definition of the Eucharist. If you don't believe in that, what do you believe in? So I agree that this cheapens the argument. Unfortunately, though, I think the argument's been cheapened now for decades.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. So, Michael, in the couple minutes or a couple seconds we got remaining, I know that, you know, we're both got very busy schedules. You said you're writing a book. Anything you're able to announce yet? Or
I am writing a book. It has to do with one of the topics that we discussed today. It has to do the only part I'll bring out now is it has to do specifically with the importance of culture, attacks on our culture, the way we think and the way we talk. I'll leave it there for right now. And it turns out, Charlie, I know you've written a book with words in it. This is my first book with words in it. Much
yes,
harder to write a book with words than a book without words.
Did you make bestseller on that other one, by the way?
I did. I was a number one bestseller. But, you know, the New York Times snubbed me. I heard not only did your book sell very well, it got an endorsement from, I believe, the leader of the free world.
That is correct. And we made the New York Times list for 2 years in a row. So we did not get snubbed. Praise God.
That's pretty good. Well, congratulations on that. It's a great book.
I could write a book on how to promote a book, but I'm not going to do that. So
I'll take the advice when the time comes.
Anytime. But Michael, this has been great. We got to continue to do this. But in closing, this is, you know, this is a very trying time for our country. And, you know, your voice is such an important one. And I look forward
to it. Well, right back at you, Charlie. And stay safe out there in your quarantine. I hope that you enjoy, like, at least 4 days of relaxation, probably more than you've had in 7 or 8 years. And, you know, then we can get back into it when this is all over.
Yeah, they're talking June now. So I don't know how I'm going to make, I don't know how I'm going to relax for the next 75 days or whatever.
Oh, no.
We'll try our best. So, all right, Michael, God bless you. See you soon.
All right, you too, Charlie. Thanks very much.
What a great conversation that was with Michael Knowles. We have another fire episode coming up tomorrow, guys. You are not going to want to miss it. So email us, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Your questions, comments, feedback, you name it. And make sure you guys are subscribed to The Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider. Hit subscribe. And finally, if you want to get involved with the most important organization in the country fighting for freedom and liberty, on college campuses across the country, but fighting virtually right now, go to tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. Thanks so much, everybody. Email us, freedom@charliekirk.com. God bless. From the creators of Cold Case Files and PD Stories come the next great true crime podcast, I Survived. Every week, I Survive presents chilling first-person accounts from people who overcame deadly situations, allowing the survivors to describe the events as they unfolded and how they made it out alive. If you love true crime, you are going to love I Survived. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week.